I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's a front burner issue for voters, and they finally have a chance to do something about campaign finance. A measure on this year's Missouri ballot is aimed at capping donations. Some lawmakers think it will help wring money out of the political system. Opponents say Amendment 2 will just make it easier for special interests to hide big donations. Then, has Election Day got you feeling anxious? A recent Stress in America survey highlights this year's contest as a significant source of stress. How to tell if you're suffering from this election stress disorder. Later this week's Local Listen with Bill Brownlee. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Missouri is one of the few states that allows unlimited campaign donations. Now voters will decide on a proposed constitutional amendment Tuesday that would cap these donations. Under the proposal, Amendment 2 would limit the amount a person could give to a candidate for the General Assembly, governor, or the courts at $2,600 an election cycle. It also would cap donations to a political party at $25,000. One argument for the proposal, it would wring a lot of money out of the Missouri political system. One argument on the other side, it would make it easier to hide big campaign donations and obscure who's giving the money. We're going to kick this around a little bit right now. With us, Missouri State Senator David Pierce. He's a Republican from the Warrensburg area, and he favors this idea. Senator, nice to have you.
It's good to be here, Steve, and appreciate the opportunity to talk about this
issue. Good deal. On the other side of the issue is Ryan Johnson. He's president of the Missouri Alliance for Freedom, a nonprofit organization that aims to protect religious and economic liberty. And Ryan, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Senator Pierce, once upon a time, you were on the other side of this issue. In fact, you voted in 2008 to eliminate these caps. Then what happened to change your mind?
2008, there was an issue in the state legislature. At that time, I was a member of the House of Representatives, and someone running for statewide office.
Yeah.
There were 99 different PACs created to help that candidate at $1,000 a piece. So that was one way to get around the system to raise nearly $100,000. At that time, there were limits. It was $325 for state rep, $650 for state senate, and then $1,250 for statewide candidates.
Okay.
And so the prevailing logic at the time was, let's just take off all the limits, let's just have 100% transparency, and that's what was decided in 2008, and it went into effect in 2009. I did vote for that, thinking that transparency would solve a lot of the problems. I look back in my 14-year career in the legislature as probably the worst vote that I ever took.
Everybody has some. Let me
do
this.
There are things you look back and wish you could change, and that's certainly one of them.
I'm going to get to Ryan Johnson's opposition in just a moment. We're joined now by Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, who's also out pushing this proposed amendment. Senator, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve, and greetings to the state senator. And I think it's refreshing to hear him talk about this, because one of the things I think people are sick of is this notion that all of us who run for office think we're perfect and never make any mistakes. I've certainly made a boatload of them, and there's votes I cast in my career that I would take back. And it's refreshing to hear him characterize what has happened in Missouri as going down a road where we have truly made a huge mistake and need to get it fixed.
Senator, you're a big proponent of sticking caps, political donation caps, back into the Missouri system. Why is that?
Well, I've never run a race. I mean, I just heard David talk about it. I've never run a race where I didn't have limits. And it's not perfect. You know, it's not like, you know, there isn't, obviously, because of Citizens United, there is some money now that is washing around in the system. But the point is that I don't have a Rex Singfield on my Rolodex. There is not a David Humphreys on my Rolodex. There are thousands of people who have given me money. And I don't have that kind of sense of obligation to one individual.
These are two big Republican donors you just referred to who have given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Missouri politicians over the years.
Millions. Yeah. Yeah, Steve, they've given millions. I mean, they write million-dollar checks to people.
Mm-hmm.
Like with one stroke of the pen, they hand a candidate for lieutenant governor $1 million. I mean, who does that unless they want something? And how do you not return their call before you think about anything else? And I just think it upsets the balance of the notion that, yes, we all have to raise money, and yes, it stinks to raise money. But I know, because I have a limit that's very similar to the limit that's in this amendment, that I have to go broad. I have to appeal to a wide number of people. I have to convince them that I'm a superior candidate. I don't have to just hang out with one or two people and have my whole campaign budget taken care of.
You know, this push to finally get caps restored in Missouri has been a long time in coming, Senator. What do you make of that? These things, the caps were tossed off back in 2008. Why has it taken so long to get them back when back in the 90s voters approved these things, like with a 75% vote?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was overturned in Jefferson City in 2008 when Matt Blunt was governor. And there was a Republican legislature. And I think that people did, I think there were some good people who thought, well, if we just had complete transparency, not realizing how out of balance and out of whack this could get. And I don't think there's been an appetite to change this in Jefferson City. And I think it takes someone, and I, once again, Fred Sauer, who put this on the ballot, I tried to give him money to help him with it. He didn't even want my money because he and I disagree on so much.
Huh.
But on this, we're 100% in agreement on. He is a very conservative. By the way, he's somebody who could play at Rex Singfield's level, and I really admire this man because even though he and I disagree on some important issues, he, instead of writing million-dollar checks to people who agree with him, he wrote $1 million checks to put limits back in place. He's the man who actually financed this effort to get this on the ballot. And I think it says a lot about his character.
That's a man named Fred Sauer out of the St. Louis area. Just a final point, Senator, how confident are you this proposed amendment's actually going to pass?
I think it will pass. I think this is what people want. Frankly, what people want even more than this is a repeal of Citizens United. You know, corporations aren't people. They can't cry. They can't get married. They can't lose a loved one. That whole line of cases culminating in Citizens United, which has allowed all this dark money to wash around in our system, really removes the voices of the little guy. We should try to strive to get to a system where all of us have thousands and thousands of donors who give us $25 instead of a handful of donors who are pulling the marionette strings like puppeteers. And I hope we can eventually get back away from the Citizens United. But in the meantime, Missouri is the only state in the union that has no rules on anything. So this would be a good first step for the state I love.
That's Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill speaking out on behalf of Missouri Amendment Number 2 on the ballot next week. Senator, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Bye.
Senator Pierce, before I get to Ryan Johnson, just real quick, when you voted to remove the caps back in 2008, did you imagine that we would be seeing the kinds of donations that we're seeing today, donations of $100,000 or, as Senator McCaskill just said, even $1 million?
Never.
Yeah.
No,
that wasn't foreseen. Right?
Not at all. We just thought the transparency would somewhat trump the issue, and these huge donations. When I ran in 2012, I had one donation of $200,000 that was given to my opponent, and that changes elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like Senator McCaskill said, two or three big checks can change the tone of a whole election. So, no, I don't think any of us ever envisioned that. And so I think that's a good reason to readdress this issue and to make some changes.
Okay, Ryan Johnson, you step into our conversation here. You oppose these caps. What impact do you think these huge donations have had on the state's reputation? What's your sense, Ryan?
Well, I can't really speak to the reputation that we enjoy nationwide, but I can speak to our concerns, and our concerns are really those First Amendment implications, a restriction of speech. So if this passes, and by the way, I suspect that this will. The one in 94 passed with 73.9% of the vote.
Okay.
I suspect it'll be a similar margin, if not even north of 73.9% this year. That's just I have no polling to back that up, but that's just my gut. But for us, a $2,600 limit really does begin to infringe on a person's speech, especially with the penalties that are then associated. So, for instance, if I give $2,650 instead of the government-approved $2,600, all of a sudden my political activity becomes criminalized. I think that's a dangerous road to go down.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say to the senator's point that she referenced the lieutenant governor's race and $1 million check being given to a candidate. A candidate that I would respectfully remind her was not ultimately successful. The money didn't work. Now, maybe it made her more of a viable candidate than she otherwise would have been.
You're referring to Bev Randles, who was a candidate on the Republican side for lieutenant governor. She's from the Kansas City area.
I believe that's who the senator was referencing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she ultimately lost her race. David was successful in his race and won his race. So the money that was spent against him or spent against Mike Parson, the Republican governor, Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, ultimately didn't prove successful. So the very notion that this is somehow corrupting the electoral policy, electoral process, just doesn't really seem to hold water, in my opinion.
But what does it do to the reputation of Missouri and Missouri politics, though, Ryan, when you do have $1 million check being written or a $200,000 check being written? A lot of voters, at least folks I talk to, recoil from this. They say the system's for sale, and that's evidence, proof positive that it is.
Well, you know, on the other side of the ball, you have large labor unions that give large checks to Democratic candidates. So
notion
that the left is out there raising dollars, you know, at $25 a pop, like the senator mentioned.
Oh, absolutely. This is a bipartisan deal
right
here.
Right.
There's no question about that.
So, you know, it happens on both sides of the aisle. And I understand that the vast majority of people are suspect of politics and politicians. I mean, the whole premise of Missouri Alliance for Freedom is based on kind of a skepticism and suspicion of politics and the political process. But I don't see that infringing upon the rights of citizens to engage in free speech, because in the modern era, especially in campaign politics, money drives message through media. It's just a fact of the world that we live in. So whatever it does to our reputation, I'm not really sure. But what I hope that it does is enhances the political process and gets more people involved. I mean, there is more money spent on pork rinds every year than we spend in politics. I wish Americans spent more money on politics and gave more money to
Is there any amount of money then, Ryan, that your organization would accept as being a reasonable limit on our political system?
You know, it would be hard to try to parse that to come up with an acceptable regulation of speech. I just don't think that regulating the speech of American citizens in the political process is the role of government.
So you want to keep a status quo then?
I enjoy the fact that people have the opportunity to express themselves, to invest in the campaigns and the candidates that they believe in, that share their ideology. And I do not support whatsoever the regulation of people's political speech.
Yeah. Let me go back to a point that Senator McCaskill made. Senator Pierce, she pointed to two businessmen, Rex Singfield of the Jefferson City area, David Humphreys from Joplin, runs Tamco Industries. They've already contributed more than $24 million between them to bankroll candidates who support their causes. What do you make of that, and what's your sense of the image that gives off here, Senator?
Well, and I would say that those are primarily to Republican candidates, but not all. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's like you referred to earlier, it's both parties that have been engaged in this. So, you know, to me, again, when I was running in 2012, there were three donors. One gave $200,000, one gave $90,000, one gave $50,000 to my opponent. So three individuals bankrolled his race for $340,000. So when that happens, I mean, you're immediately behind, and you have
mm-hmm.
to work hard, and you have to really out-hustle your opponent to do that. And I think
And you're behind because that money ends up doing what?
Oh, it buys access, it buys commercials, it buys direct mail, it buys consultants, ground workers, grassroots, and so you've really, really got to work hard. Now, in our particular case, as Ryan said, we won. We were victorious. And quite honestly, one of the messages that we said was, do you want a St. Louis billionaire telling you who your next state senator should be?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to overcome that, but we had to focus on that probably more than just focusing on the issues. And I think when we took these limits off, I don't think that we in the legislature nor the Missourians felt that would be a byproduct of that.
You know, the other argument you hear sometimes, and Ryan, you might want to chime in here, is if you take the caps off, then candidates like yourself are going to spend all your time raising money in small chunks at a time, as opposed to being out talking to regular folks and finding out what their concerns are.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had to spend so much time raising money just to keep even. And right at that time, that was the Summer Olympics going on. TV rates were extremely high. Our opponent went on Kansas City TV market, so we had to. And so it was just a race to raise the funds. And so I think these unlimited contributions just pollute the system. Mm-hmm. And most states have limits. Missouri has had limits. We have limits on the federal level. And so it's been proven to be constitutional that, yes, we can put limits on these. And I think that we need to have some limits on here. $2,600, I don't think that's the magical number, but I do think that limits are important.
I'm going to come right to you, Ryan. Let me get our listeners involved here. If you want to join our conversation with your thoughts on this this amendment, this proposed amendment here, Amendment 2, is it time to put caps back on Missouri political donations or not? 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Ryan, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. Yeah. You know, on the flip side of that coin, when a candidate is running against an incumbent, Amendment 2 could, for all intents and purposes, be called the Incumbent Protection Amendment. And I can point out a local Kansas City case. We recently experienced some primaries, Republican versus Republican, in the Blue Springs area. State Representative Sheila Salone lost her primary, lost it to a relatively unknown political newcomer named Dan Stacey. Dan Stacey, at the very outset of his campaign, you might describe as not a viable candidate. Mm-hmm. I know, and I have his permission to share his story, but I know just from conversation with him that he began to make the fundraising calls as candidates will do, and very quickly the people in the district said, "We love you, Dave, but we just can't do that. We can't give money against our sitting state representative." David Humphreys, who you mentioned, I believe gave that campaign $25,000, and all of a sudden he had a viable campaign. He did some mail, bought some signs, and did his doors, which is direct voter contact, and he pulled off an almost 10-point victory. So that kind of money also can take a person who would not necessarily normally be a viable or considered a viable candidate by the establishment and all of a sudden put them in the race. And the constituents of Representative Salone chose him over her in that case.
And that's interesting. You think putting the donation caps back on, Ryan, it's going to result in incumbents gaining some new protections here to keep winning re-election.
Absolutely.
And I would disagree with that. The reason why this money was given to my opponent was because I was an incumbent. I was chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Some of the votes we had taken was not popular with some of the big donors, so they wanted me out. They wanted me out as Senate Education Chair. They wanted me out of the Senate because I was an incumbent. So I do think that it can
go both
ways.
So it can work both ways. And but to your point, though, David, I mean, you were reelected successfully. And right. I can't remember what the margin was, but I think it was a pretty healthy margin.
It's a healthy margin.
So, you know, David had to work harder. He had to raise more money. He had to be on the air. What you had was a vigorous political contest, which I would encourage, quite frankly, rather than just a cakewalk into reelection. You had a vigorous contest. You were ultimately successful, and the money given against you didn't work. So, you know, the notion that this money somehow corrupts the process or, you know, skews it in one or the other's favor, I just don't think really has a lot of merit.
You go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Larry from Mission. Larry, you're on the program. Good morning. We're talking about Amendment 2 and placing contribution limits back on contributions in Missouri. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a comment about the free speech aspect of giving unlimited sums of money.
Yeah.
Well, now you're quantifying the value of somebody's speech. If somebody has 10 times more money than I do, then their speech seems to make more difference than mine would, because I can't express it in that same manner.
So that seems
totally unfair.
So your point is what? That you're for or against?
Well, I'm for the limits, and the reason is they keep saying it's free speech. Well, how is somebody with 100 grand more free speech than mine with one?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fair playing field.
Yeah, Larry, I appreciate that. Ryan, respond if you would.
So the answer then is to make sure that everybody only gets to enjoy $2,600 worth of free speech? I just, again, have a philosophical and fundamental disagreement with the caller.
Okay. You go back to some calls, and Mary from Lee Summit. Mary, you're on the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm interested in when you're talking about the transparency involved with the donors to different campaigns. When we're researching our candidates, where does the average voter find that information? Who has donated to what campaign and how much?
Senator, tell them about the Missouri Ethics Commission.
Right. In the state of Missouri, it would be the Missouri Ethics Commission. And you can just go online, www.missouriethicscommission, and you can go to the individual candidate, or if it's an issue, you can go to that issue. All of the donations are there. And then on a quarterly basis, the campaigns have to issue the money that they brought in as well as the money that they spent. Registered lobbyists also have to report on a monthly basis any money that they spend on behalf of a candidate. Now, one thing we haven't talked about are the 501c4 corporations, the
right.
educational corporations that are out there that have not heretofore revealed the identity of donors to those corporations, and I think they should. In mm-hmm. fact, in the Senate, we tried to do that on a tie vote of 15 to 15 on an amendment to one of our ethics bills. It did not pass. But right now, people can donate to 501c4 not-for-profit corporations, and their identity is never revealed.
That's Citizens United at Work then, right?
And yeah. So to me, I think if people want to donate, that's their business, but those identities should be revealed.
Okay.
Of course, I disagree with that.
Because, Ryan,
well,
and Mary, thank you for your call.
Well, and in full disclosure, I mean, Missouri Alliance for Freedom is a nonprofit company. It is a 501c4, as David mm-hmm. mentioned. You also have 501c3 think tanks like the Show Me Institute, which does a lot of good research on the conservative issue side of the ball. And from time to time, we get to work together and collaborate on certain things. These are small, private, again, nonprofit companies. We don't engage in electioneering. We don't even endorse candidates, and we never have in our brief existence. And, you know, anonymous political speech is as American as apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall our Federalist Papers, they were all written under pseudonyms. This was the primary arguments for the passage of our Constitution that, you know, Democrat, Republican, Independent, we all appreciate.
Well, shouldn't people have a sense of who's saying what, though, and who's giving what?
Well, you know, from that argument, we could also say who funds KCUR, and may the politicians and government receive a list of your internal financials so that we know where all of your money is coming from, because you have the audacity to comment on politics and policy. And, of course, you and I would find that notion ridiculous.
Well, a lot of those donors, their names are released in our
sure.
flyers. That's public information.
Well, and in the nonprofit world, you know, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about the UMKC Foundation or the Kauffman Foundation or a 501c3 or 4 like us, you know, donor relations is really considered sacrosanct. So, for instance, if you have a donor and they want to put their name on a building, you typically do that.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to remain anonymous, you also honor that as well. And that exists whether you're funding cancer research or whether you're funding policy research.
Go back to some phone calls. Stacy from Kansas City, Missouri. Stacy, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling They'd said that it won't affect the electoral process. You can't buy a candidate in. But what happens if a candidate is elected? What would the influence be of the millions of dollars given to them?
What influence will big donors have after a candidate's elected? Senator Pierce, you've worked down there for 14 years. What influence do rich folks have?
Well, and Senator McCaskill talked about this, that raising funds is a necessary evil of politics. My race cost about $500,000, so you have to have that.
Wow.
But you would hope that one or two main donors wouldn't have the direct influence and be able to sway that elected official's point of view once they were in office.
And do you see that? Did you see that when you were down there for so many years? Do rich folks have more sway?
That's a tough question to ask. I'd like to think that it didn't mm-hmm. make a difference. I think it probably has more direct involvement in the actual election as opposed to then policy. But, you know, quite honestly, once you're in office and one or two major donors have actually helped put you there, you can't ignore when you get their phone calls or when you get their emails.
You know, Senator Pierce used to be my state senator. My little girls and I marched in parades for Senator Pierce in support of his candidacy. And, you know, I like to think, and I don't think I'm being naive here, I'd like to think that Senator Pierce returned my phone call just as readily as he did whoever his largest donor is.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, and I'd like to think that he gave me the same good constituent services that he did for his largest donor. I've seen no evidence of you know, pay to play in Senator Pierce's career, and I certainly hope that it would not.
Well, what about the passage of
the process?
Big, the income tax cut in Missouri that a lot of critics said was a direct result of Rex Singfield, the big businessman from the Jefferson City area, sprinkling around so many donations to so many candidates, and big donations at that.
Well, you know, he's an ideological man, as far as I know. I don't know him well, but it's my understanding that education reform and tax reform are two of his policy priorities.
That's my point. Did that bill pass because Rex Singfield was giving away so many donations?
Well, I don't think, you know, Republican-controlled majorities, veto-proof majorities in both chambers of the Missouri legislature, agreeing with someone like that on the issues of tax reform and education reform or other things like that is really, you know, newsworthy. So in terms of whether or not his money influenced that vote, I really can't speak to
Senator
that.
Senator Pierce, what's your perspective on that? Did his money influence that vote?
Oh, it maybe was some. We had basically two votes on a tax cut bill. One was 3 years ago, and then one was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
One passed, one didn't. So and I, in fact, voted for the second one. So so I don't know if you can just unilaterally say that made a difference in that particular issue.
I want to get to one more point about Amendment 2 before we go here. What about this concern that if the amendment passes, Senator Pierce, that this will see – that will see a mega donations made in Missouri, only they'll be obscured and hidden from public view because people will not want to attach their names to them? Is that possible?
It's possible, but you know, to me, I sometimes we say, well, if we do this, then this will happen, or people will try to circumvent the law. I mean, to me, I think this is a good idea. It should be voted on. It should be approved. And there might be people who try to skirt around that, who try to hide, who try to avoid transparency. But it's still not a reason not to vote for it. And I think this is a step in the right direction.
Okay. That's our conversation on Amendment 2, placing caps back on Missouri political donations. I want to thank Missouri State Senator David Pierce from the Warrensburg area. Senator, appreciate it very much. Thank you for your service. You're just wrapping up 14 years,
right? Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be here.
You bet. And other side of the equation here, Ryan Johnson, president of the Missouri Alliance for Freedom. Ryan, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about election stress disorder. Maybe you're affected by it, too. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we got an elections update from reporters covering Kansas and Missouri. Also, political commentator E.J. Dionne gave us some historical perspective on the national elections. You can hear those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, tomorrow, the ethics professors return to examine the moral questions stemming from current events and trends. Well, every year for the past decade, the American Psychological Association has underwritten the Stress in America survey to gain a sense of how stress affects the health and well-being of average Americans. While the full results of the survey won't be available until early 2017, the APA did highlight some specific data pertinent to current events. It should come as no surprise that this year's election is a very or somewhat significant source of stress. Here to go over the causes and symptoms of election stress disorder is Stan Tackin. He's a director of psychology with a marriage and family therapy degree. Dr. Tackin has been with us before as part of our TEDxKC series this summer, and he wrote about election stress disorder for Psychology Today. He joins us today by Skype from California. And Stan, welcome back. So good to have you.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be back with you.
I'll be honest. This election stress disorder thing sounds a little gimmicky to me. Is this a real diagnosis or just a clever way, you know, to get clicks and sell more magazines?
It's not in the DSM, at least not yet. But no, it's not in the DSM. And it's the APA.
Not in the DSM, meaning what?
The Diagnostic Statistical Manual. So it's not an actual bona fide psychiatric disorder. But I think the APA called it as such because this year in particular, people are complaining. People are really feeling very upset throughout this whole election cycle with these two candidates and what's been going on actually in the entire country. So I think the tone is getting to people, you know, the nasty tone that has gone on now for quite a while. And so people are becoming obsessed. you know, they can't get enough of this, but they get too much of it. They listen to the surrogates, they listen to the, you know, pundits, and I think people are worn down by it, much like being in a family where the parents are fighting,
yeah,
and tearing each other down all the time.
Well, if our listeners want to call in, I'd be eager to hear from folks who might think they are suffering from election stress disorder. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So break it down for me, Stan. How do I know if I am suffering from election stress disorder?
You probably would just volunteer that you are, because you're on edge every day, because you're probably, you know, can't stop listening to the news, can't stop, you know, watching YouTube, the clips, all the things that people are saying and doing. Almost a day doesn't go by where there isn't something controversial or something that doesn't sound very depressing about the future or about the candidates. And so if you're not feeling it, you probably wouldn't identify with it. You wouldn't say anything. But there are a lot of people who are. And some of it's causing some trouble in the home, too, as well.
Ah, any sense of how widespread something like this might be?
There's no way to tell. I don't think there's any statistics as of yet. But certainly, you know, people are talking about it, right? People,
everyone's talking about it. Yeah.
But they roll their eyes, they wring their hands, they go, what are we going to do? And my friend is voting for this, I can't talk to them. My husband is voting for this, I can't talk to him. And so this is unique. I've never experienced anything like this before.
Because there's genuine concern, there's genuine fear if Donald Trump wins for many Democrats, and vice versa, if Hillary Clinton wins for many Republicans. You know, I talked to a friend of mine yesterday who's a Republican who was just going on and on, normally a very mild-mannered guy, just lit up over the idea of Hillary Clinton becoming president, because he views her as a crook on the lam, basically, and just was very upset about it.
The hyperbole and the kind of dialogue that we've been getting, you know, this election cycle, especially with Trump, who basically lets it all out. I mean, he does appeal to the most primitive parts of us many times, and then we have phrases like, you know, send her to jail, and you know, criminal on the lam. But we also get people on the other side too, that we're gonna end up with a dictator, you know, somebody who's a psychopath. So there's a lot of hyperbole to go around.
We have our first caller who says he's suffering from election stress disorder. Let's go to Brad from Liberty. Brad, tell us about it, because I think whatever you say is probably going to be relatable for a lot of folks. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. As soon as I go home, I turn on the TV and the news is already on, and it's always about, you know, Trump or, you know, one of the candidates. And I really don't want to watch it. I've had so much of it, but I'm hooked. And it's like, you know, a train wreck, you know, where I can't take my eyes off of it. And then I feel kind of sick to my stomach because of there's so much negativity that it's just overwhelmed my life.
How does it affect your mood then, Brad, going forward from those moments?
I have been glued to it since day one. I've watched every one of the debates, you know, start to finish. And when it wasn't so bad at first, but now it seems like I just feel, you know, sluggish and depressed.
Wow. Yeah.
And I just feel like, you know, that it's our whole country is, you know, kind of being taken in this direction of, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but it's not good.
Well, Brett, I appreciate your phone call. If anyone else wants to call in, 816-235-2888. Stan, explain this to me. In Brad's case, he says the whole thing wears him out, makes him feel sluggish, and yet he can't keep his eyes off it. Why would you do that if the thing is driving you crazy?
Well, it's like the worst reality television show ever. There's a level, and I don't want to overstate it, but there's a level of violence this year And we saw it in the Republican debates, but also in the presidential debates. And when I say violence, I don't mean, you know, anybody hurting each other, but there are threats. There are threats, you know, ad hominem attacks. There are, you know, deeply disturbing, humiliating, shaming things that happen during the debates and after the debates, name calling. But I mean, really tearing down. I don't think I've ever seen such a kind of a scorched earth policy when it comes to winning the presidency. Almost anything goes. Anything goes. People can say anything. You know, this has been a nightmare year for fact checking. And I think it really is being exposed to the you know, quote unquote violence of this season and what we're hearing.
Stan, do you think it affects Republicans or Democrats at different rates?
I think it's affecting everybody. I think there are plenty of Republicans who are disgusted with their candidate, plenty of Democrats disgusted with their candidate. I think there's enough to be disgusted about to go around in both sides of the aisle. And we're going to have to see what happens post-election to see what can and what, if anything, will be repaired.
Ah, that's interesting. Again, our number 816-235-2888. Let's go to Drew from Kansas City, Missouri. Drew, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I was just talking to your producer, and it's just caused huge problems. I mean, I'm sweating just talking about it. I'm petrified. I hold my breath, and I couldn't watch the debates because I can't stand to look at one of the candidates, the Trump, and it's caused a huge problem. I take care of my 90-year-old mother, and she voted for him, and I can hardly look at her. I'm so profoundly disappointed in her. I'm practically out of control on it. See, I'm about to cry. Petrified of him.
And why? What is it about him that unnerves you so much, Drew?
I think he's a despicable person who will do despicable things, and I don't think he cares anything about anybody but himself. Mm-hmm. And I just can't believe he's gotten this far. I'm profoundly disappointed in our whole country that he's gotten this far, just like I was profoundly proud when we elected Obama. But the fact that he's gotten this far, and that my own mother, who's a feminist and a rational person, voted for him, it's just caused a huge problem. I'm not proud of it, but you know, if I had a spouse that was a Trump supporter, I don't know what I'd do. Luckily, I don't.
Stan, talk to Drew a little bit here.
Well, this is, you know, you're in good company, and I'd like to say, well, okay, definitely. You know, there's a lot to fear about Trump, you know, in terms of his behavior, and he speaks to, you know, in some ways acts like, it may remind people of some kind of abusive parent, that is, you know, that is, a little bit scary. But a lot of people also, you know, whether you agree or disagree, I don't agree, but a lot of people see Hillary in some way that, you know, that she's a demon and that she's a criminal and that she's going to do horrible things. So we're dealing with perception here, and everybody has their reason for voting for one candidate or the other. I don't think they're the same. I understand the disappointment in that. And it's happening between spouses where one is voting for Trump and the other one's voting for Hillary. And imagine what they're doing, and what that's like at home.
Boy, I can't imagine. Lisa from Overland Park, you're on the air. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share that I have been having Trump anxiety for over a year. I was experiencing it a year ago, November, as I came to the realization that I believed that he would become the nominee. And then I understood that come this spring that there's been sort of a labeling of that. So I became obsessively Googling him every day until this past Saturday when I went in and voted.
Wow.
And within 24 hours, my obsessiveness has abated.
Hmm. Okay, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much for the call, Lisa. I appreciate it, and good luck.
And
okay.
That's my point.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
How do you recommend, Stan, that someone avoid election stress? What's your two cents?
Well, your last caller said something that's very important, and I think this is why people will feel better if they vote. The worst thing you can do is not do anything and sit back and then give up because you don't like anything. Getting out and voting is a way to be active and not passive, sitting in front of the television set or listening to the news and waiting for the next bad thing to come out. Taking action, you know, voting, I think, is going to relieve a lot of people's stress. And also, if you stop listening to this, I don't think there's anything right now to gain by following the news.
Yeah.
If you really are undecided, and it's hard to imagine, you know, people being decided at this undecided at this point, it would be to really think about, soberly think about the candidates, what you really want in a candidate, or at least what you want, you know, don't want, and vote that way and not what you're hearing. You know, really think, really research, and do the footwork, but vote.
Election stress disorder is our topic here. Let's go to Paula from Parkville. Paula, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm really stressed about the lack of veracity in the ads that we see on TV all the time. It reminds me of an Inquirer magazine or the Star, one of those, you know, tabloid things where there's 10% maybe truth in there somewhere, but it's been twisted around. And there used to be truth in advertising laws. I mean, doesn't that apply to campaigns and things like that? And it's that lack of, you know, truthfulness that's really, really got me angry.
So for you, Paul, it's not a specific candidate. It's just the overall sense that these guys aren't being truthful in their TV ads.
That, and not just the presidents, but if you look at the local, you know, for governor and all of those, I mean, it is just one says one thing and one counters it with something else.
Yeah.
Like, who knows what the truth is? And it's just so disturbing.
Yeah. Stan, what about it?
I think there's a lot of blowback this year from basically making stuff up. That's happening a lot this year. There's, again, the fact-checking issue. There seems to be a lot of looseness with facts. And never before have we seen this, where people are just making stuff up. There's so much information out there, false information. And the media is at an all-time low in terms of public trust.
Yes.
People do not trust the media, and it's a great deal of it has to come out. Yeah, comes out of this political season. So
there's no arbiter of this stuff anymore. Yeah.
No, all the rules are being broken, and people are kind of watching all the rules being broken. I think this is also adding to the stress. It feels like chaos.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of the hopelessness is, what are we going to be like after this election? You know, what is this going to continue? Is this going to get worse with the next elections?
Yeah.
Right? We're seeing trends of so much unfairness, so much lying and making stuff up. It's out of control.
Well, Stan Tatkin, a doctor of psychology with a marriage and family therapy degree. He's been with us before. Stan, I sure appreciate your time. And sorry I couldn't get to all our calls here. The board is lit. Lots of folks suffering here. Charlie, Cheryl, Michael, David, I'm sorry we couldn't get to your calls. Stan, thanks so much for joining us again.
Take care, Steve.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee's in studio with us now once again. And Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
He wants to talk to us about a musical act from Kansas City that's doing some interesting stuff out there. How about Emmaline Twist?
Yes, Emmaline Twist is a group of Kansas City musicians who are in their 30s and 40s.
Wow.
I've been around the block.
They're like really old. Then,
they're
right?
Old.
Yeah.
And I've been around the block a few times, so I know that, you know, rock and roll is a music that is often best made by teenagers and people in their 20s. You know, that's when the, you know, revolutions happen. But Emmaline Twist proves that people at that advanced age can make very vital rock and roll.
Well, let's listen to this group's track. This one's titled Vega.
Careful.
That's Emmeline Twist. The track is titled Vega. Is Emmeline Twist a person?
No, it's a group of four group. Musicians okay. Yeah. Who have been around the Kansas City scene for a while.
That's a great voice.
She's a great singer. My personal favorite element of the band is that guitar by Christoph Nemeth. I just love that sound. He used to be in a group called the Late Night Callers.
How long has Emmeline Twist been around, Bill?
Just a few months. They played a handful of shows, and their next show is this Saturday at the Record Bar.
If you go online, can you find their music?
Yeah, they have two songs out on Bandcamp. This is one of the two. They're both terrific. I know that they're working on a record that will be released by the in-house record label of the venue, the Record Bar.
This song has kind of a little bit of a dark, melancholy sound attached to it. Is their music sort of that way?
For certain. I think fans of The Cure and Joy Division will hear lots of elements of those bands in Emmeline Twist sound.
This show on Saturday at the Record Bar is a benefit show. Tell us a little more about it.
Yes, there's a group in town called the Midwest Music Foundation.
Yeah.
They're dedicated to promoting the welfare of Kansas City musicians of all genres. And their big annual benefit is called Apocalypse Meow. It starts Friday at Mills Record Company and continues Saturday at Record Bar. And that show features Madison Ward and the Mama Bear.
So lots of good folks playing that night then.
Lots of good music on Saturday at the Record Bar starting at 7 o'clock. Emmeline Twist, the band we're listening to now, starts at 10:30. And Madison Ward, the Mama Bear, are on at 9.
Wow, okay. Reason to live. That's Bill Brownlee talking about Emmeline Twist. Bill, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, the ethics professors are back. They'll take on some current issues and the moral dilemmas they give rise to. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up-to-date.